cards actually were put to use.
Eventually, the major's friend had shown up at the store to hear Childen's historically first-hand account. That man, also a retired officer of the Imperial Army, had been fascinated. "Bottle caps!" Childen had exclaimed without warning. The Japanese had blinked uncomprehendingly. "We used to collect the tops from milk bottles. As kids. The round tops that gave the name of the dairy. There must have been thousands of dairies in the United States. Each one printed a special top." The officer's eyes had glinted with the instinct.
"Do you possess any of your sometime collection, sir?"
Naturally, Childen did not. But probably it was still possible to obtain the ancient, long-forgotten tops from the days before the war when milk had come in glass bottles rather than throwaway pasteboard cartons. And so, by stages, he had gotten into the business. Others had opened similar places, taking advantage of the ever-growing Japanese craze for Americana, but Childen had always kept his edge.
"Your fare," the Chink was saying, bringing him out of his meditation, "is a dollar, sir."
He had unloaded the bags and was waiting. Absent-mindedly, Childen paid him.
Yes, it was quite likely that the client of Mr. Tagomi resembled Major Humo. At least, Childen thought tartly, from my point of view. He had dealt with so many Japanese, but he still had difficulty telling them apart. There were the short, squat ones, built like wrestlers. Then the druggist-like ones. The tree-shrub-flower-gardener ones. He had his categories. And the young ones, who were to him not like Japanese at all. Mr. Tagomi's client would probably be portly, a businessman, smoking a Philippine cigar. And then, standing before the Nippon Times building, with his bags on the sidewalk beside him, Childen suddenly thought with a chill,
suppose his client isn't Japanese.
Everything in the bags had been selected with them in mind, their tastes. But the man had to be Japanese. A Civil War recruiting poster had been Mr. Tagomi's original order. Surely only a Japanese would care about such debris. Typical of their mania for the trivial, their legalistic fascination with documents, proclamations, ads. He remembered one who had devoted his leisure time to collecting newspaper ads of American patent medicines of the 1900s. There were other problems to face. Immediate problems. Through the high doors of the Nippon Times building, men and women hurried, all of them well-dressed. Their voices reached Childen's ears, and he started into motion. A glance upward at the towering edifice, the highest building in San Francisco. Wall of offices, windows, the fabulous design of the Japanese architects, and the surrounding gardens of dwarf evergreens, rocks, the Karasansui landscape, sand imitating a dried-up stream winding past roots among simple, irregular flat stones. He saw a black who had carried baggage, now free. At once Childen called,
"Porter!"
The black trotted toward him, smiling.
"To the 20th floor," Childen said in his harshest voice. "Sweet B, at once."
He indicated the bags and then strode on toward the doors of the building. Naturally, he did not look back. A moment later, he found himself being crowded into one of the express elevators, mostly Japanese around him, their clean faces shining slightly in the brilliant light of the elevator. Then the nauseating upward thrust of the elevator, the rapid click of floors passing. He shut his eyes, planted his feet firmly, prayed for the flight to end. The black, of course, had taken the bags up on a service elevator. It would not have been within the realm of reason to permit him here. In fact, Childen opened his eyes and looked momentarily. He was one of the few whites in the elevator. When the elevator let him off on the 20th floor, Childen was already bowing mentally, preparing himself for the encounter in Mr. Tagomi's offices. 3. At sunset, glancing up, Juliana Frank saw the dot of light in the sky shoot in an arc, disappear to the west.
One of those Nazi rocket ships, she said to herself, flying to the coast, full of big shots. And here I am down below.
She waved, although the rocket ship, of course, had already gone. Shadows advancing from the Rockies, blue peaks turning to night. A flock of slow birds, migratory, made their way parallel with the mountains. Here and there a car turned its headlights on. She saw the twin dots along the highway. Lights, too, of a gas station. Houses. For months now, she had been living here in Canyon City, Colorado. She was a judo instructor. Her workday had ended, and she was preparing to take a shower. She felt tired. All the showers were in use by customers of Ray's gym, so she had been standing, waiting outdoors in the coolness, enjoying the smell of mountain air. The quiet. All she heard now was the faint murmur from the hamburger stand down the road by the highway's edge. Two huge diesel trucks had parked, and the drivers, in the gloom, could be seen moving about, putting on their leather jackets before entering the hamburger stand. She thought, didn't Diesel throw himself out the window of his stateroom? Commit suicide by drowning himself on an ocean voyage? Maybe I ought to do that. But here, there was no ocean. But there is always a way. Like in Shakespeare. A pin stuck through one's shirt front, and goodbye, Frank. The girl who need not fear marauding homeless from the desert walks upright in consciousness of many pinched nerve possibilities in grizzled, salivating adversary. Death instead by, say, sniffing car exhaust in highway town, perhaps through long hollow straw.
Learned that, she thought, from Japanese. Imbibed placid attitude toward mortality, along with money-making judo. How to kill, how to die. Yang and yin. But that's behind now. This is Protestant land.
It was a good thing to see the Nazi rockets go by overhead and not stop. Not take any interest of any sort in Canyon City, Colorado. Nor in Utah or Wyoming, or the eastern part of Nevada. None of the open, empty desert states or pasture states.
We have no value, she said to herself. We can live out our tiny lives, if we want to, if it matters to us.
From one of the showers, the noise of a door unlocking. A shape, large Miss Davis, finished with her shower, dressed, purse under her arm.
Oh, were you waiting, Mrs. Frank? I'm sorry. It's all right, Juliana said. You know, Mrs. Frank, I've gotten so much out of judo, even more than out of Zen. I wanted to tell you.
Slim your hips the Zen way, Juliana said. Lose pounds through painless Satori.
I'm sorry, Miss Davis. I'm wool gathering.
Miss Davis said,
Did they hurt you much?
Who?
The Japs, before you learned to defend yourself. It was dreadful, Juliana said. You've never been out there, on the coast, where they are.
I've never been outside of Colorado, Miss Davis said, her voice fluttering timidly.
It could happen here, Juliana said. They might decide to occupy this region, too.
Not this late!
You never know what they're going to do, Juliana said. They hide their real thoughts.
What did they make you do?
Miss Davis, hugging her purse against her body with both arms, moved closer, in the evening darkness, to hear. Everything, Juliana said.
Oh, God! I'd fight, Miss Davis said. Juliana excused herself and walked to the vacant shower. Someone else was approaching it with a towel over her arm. Later, she sat in a booth at Tasty Charlie's Broiled Hamburgers, listlessly reading the menu. The jukebox played some hillbilly tune, steel guitar and emotion-choked moaning. The air was heavy with grease smoke. And yet, the place was warm and bright, and it cheered her. The presence of the truck drivers at the counter, the waitress, the big Irish fry cook in his white jacket at the register making change. Seeing her, Charlie approached to wait on her himself. Grinning, he drawled,
"Missy want tea, no?"
"Coffee," Juliana said, enduring the fry cook's relentless humor.
"Ah, so,"
Charlie said, nodding. "And the hot steak sandwich with gravy."
"Not have bowl rat's nest soup? Or maybe goat brains fried in olive oil?"
A couple of the truck drivers, turning on their stools, grinned along with the gag, too. And in addition, they took pleasure in noticing how attractive she was. Even lacking the fry cook's kidding, she would have found the truck drivers scrutinizing her. The months of active judo had given her unusual muscle tone. She knew how well she held herself and what it did for her figure.
"It all has to do with the shoulder muscles," she thought as she met their gaze. "Dancers do it, too. It has nothing to do with size. Send your wives around to the gym, and we'll teach them. And you'll be so much more content in life."
"Stay away from her,"
the fry cook warned the truck drivers with a wink.
"She'll throw you on your can."
She said to the younger of the truck drivers,
"Where are you in from?"
"Missouri,"
both men said.
"Are you from the United States?"
she asked.
"I am,"
the older man said.
"Philadelphia. Got 3 kids there. The oldest is 11.
"Listen," Juliana said. "Is it easy to get a good job back there?"
The younger truck driver said,
"Sure, if you have the right color skin."
He himself had a dark, brooding face with curly black hair. His expression had become set and bitter.
"He's a wop," the older man said.
"Well," Juliana said, "didn't Italy win the war?"
She smiled at the young truck driver, but he did not smile back. Instead, his somber eyes glowed even more intensely, and suddenly he turned away.
"I'm sorry," she thought, but she said nothing. "I can't save you or anybody else from being dark."
She thought of Frank.
"I wonder if he's dead yet. Said the wrong thing, spoke out of line. No," she thought. "Somehow he likes Japs.
Maybe he identifies with them because they're ugly." She had always told Frank that he was ugly. Large pores, big nose. Her own skin was finely knit, unusually so.
"Did he fall dead without me? A fink is a finch, a form of bird. And they say birds die. Are you going back on the road tonight?"
she asked the young Italian truck driver.
"Tomorrow. If you're not happy in the U.S., why don't you cross over permanently?" she said. "I've been living in the Rockies for a long time, and it isn't so bad. I lived on the coast, in San Francisco. They have the skin thing there, too."
Glancing briefly at her as he sat hunched at the counter, the young Italian said, "Lady, it's bad enough to have to spend one day or one night in a town like this.
Live here? Christ, if I could get any other kind of job and not have to be on the road eating my meals in places like this."
Noticing that the fry cook was red, he ceased speaking and began to drink his coffee. The older truck driver said to him,
"Joe, you're a snob."
"You could live in Denver," Juliana said. "It's nicer up there." "I know you East Americans," she thought. "You like the big time, dreaming your big schemes. This is just the sticks to you, the Rockies. Nothing has happened here since before the war. Retired old people, farmers, the stupid, slow, poor. And all the smart boys have flocked east to New York, crossed the border legally or illegally. Because," she thought, "that's where the money is. The big industrial money. The expansion. German investment has done a lot. It didn't take long for them to build the U.S. back up."
The fry cook said in a hoarse, angry voice,
"Buddy, I'm not a Jew lover, but I've seen some of those Jew refugees flee in your U.S. in 49, and you can have your U.S.
If there's a lot of building back there and a lot of loose, easy money, it's because they stole it from those Jews when they kicked them out of New York, that goddamn Nazi Nuremberg law. I lived in Boston when I was a kid, and I got no special use for Jews, but I never thought I'd see that Nazi racial law get passed in the U.S., even if we did lose the war. I'm surprised you aren't in the U.S. Armed Forces, getting ready to invade some little South American republic as a front for the Germans, so they can push the Japanese back a little bit more.
Both truck drivers were on their feet, their faces stark. The older man picked up a ketchup bottle from the counter and held it upright by the neck. The fry cook, without turning his back to the two men, reached behind him until his fingers touched one of his meat forks. He brought the fork out and held it.
Juliana said, "Denver is getting one of those heat-resistant runways so that the Lufthansa rockets can land there."
None of the three men moved or spoke. The other customers sat silently. Finally, the fry cook said,
"One flew over around sundown."
"It wasn't going to Denver," Juliana said. "It was going west, to the coast."
By degrees, the two truck drivers reseated themselves. The older man mumbled,
"I always forget. They're a little yellow out here."
The fry cook said,
"No Japs killed Jews, in the war or after. No Japs built ovens." "Too bad they didn't," the older truck driver said.
But, picking up his coffee cup, he resumed eating.
"Yellow," Juliana thought. "Yes, I suppose it's true. We love the Japs out here." "Where are you staying?" she asked, speaking to the young truck driver, Joe. "Overnight."
"I don't know," he answered. "I just got out of the truck to come in here. I don't like this whole state. Maybe I'll sleep in the truck." "The Honeybee Motel isn't too bad," the fry cook said.
"Okay,"
the young truck driver said. "Maybe I'll stay there, if they don't mind me being Italian."
He had a definite accent, although he tried to hide it. Watching him, Juliana thought,
"It's idealism that makes him that bitter. Asking too much out of life. Always moving on, restless and griped. I'm the same way. I couldn't stay on the West Coast, and eventually I won't be able to stand it here. Weren't the old-timers like that?" "But," she thought, "now the frontier isn't here. It's the other planets."
She thought,
"He and I could sign up for one of those colonizing rocket ships. But the Germans would disbar him because of his skin, and me because of my dark hair. Those pale, skinny Nordic SS fairies in those training castles in Bavaria. This guy, Joe whatever, hasn't even got the right expression on his face. He should have that cold but somehow enthusiastic look, as if he believed in nothing and yet somehow had absolute faith. Yes, that's how they are. They're not idealists like Joe and me. They're cynics with utter faith. It's a sort of brain defect, like a lobotomy, that maiming those German psychiatrists do as a poor substitute for psychotherapy. Their trouble," she decided, "is with sex. They did something foul with it back in the 30s, and it has gotten worse. Hitler started it with his, what was she, his sister? Aunt? Niece? And his family was inbred already. His mother and father were cousins. They're all committing incest, going back to the original sin of lusting for their own mothers. That's why they, those elite SS fairies, have that angelic simper, that blonde baby-like innocence. They're saving themselves for Mama. Or for each other." "And who is Mama for them?" she wondered. "The leader? Herr Bormann, who is supposed to be dying? Or the sick one?"
"Old Adolf, supposed to be in a sanitarium somewhere, living out his life of senile paresis. Syphilis of the brain, dating back to his poor days as a bum in Vienna. Long black coat, dirty underwear, flophouses. Obviously, it was God's sardonic vengeance, right out of some silent movie. That awful man struck down by an internal filth.
the historic plague for man's wickedness. And the horrible part was that the present-day German Empire was a product of that brain. First a political party, then a nation, then half the world. And the Nazis themselves had diagnosed it, identified it. That quack herbal medicine man who had treated Hitler, that Dr. Morell who had dosed Hitler with a patent medicine called Dr. Custer's anti-gas pills. He had originally been a specialist in venereal disease. The entire world knew it. And yet the leader's gabble was still sacred, still holy writ. The views had infected a civilization by now, and, like evil spores, the blind, blonde Nazi queens were swishing out from Earth to the other planets, spreading the contamination. What you get for incest? Madness, blindness, death.
Brr.
She shook herself.
Charlie, she called to the fry cook, you about ready with my order?
She felt absolutely alone. Getting to her feet, she walked to the counter and seated herself by the register. No one noticed her except the young Italian truck driver. His dark eyes were fixed on her. Joe, his name was.
Joe what?
She wondered. Closer to him now, she saw that he was not as young as she had thought. Hard to tell. The intensity all around him disturbed her judgment. Continually, he drew his hand through his hair, combing it back with crooked, rigid fingers.
There's something special about this man, she thought. He breathes death.
It upset her, and yet attracted her. Now the older truck driver inclined his head and whispered to him. Then they both scrutinized her, this time with a look that was not the ordinary male interest.
Miss,
the older one said. Both men were quite tense now.
Do you know what this is?
He held up a flat white box, not too large.
Yes, Juliana said. Nylon stockings, synthetic fiber made only by the great cartel in New York, IG Farben. Very rare and expensive.
You gotta hand it to the Germans. Monopoly's not a bad idea.
The older truck driver passed the box to his companion, who pushed it with his elbow along the counter toward her.
You have a car?
The young Italian asked her, sipping his coffee. From the kitchen, Charlie appeared. He had her plate.
You could drive me to this place?
The wild, strong eyes still studied her, and she became increasingly nervous, and yet increasingly transfixed.
This motel, or wherever I'm supposed to stay tonight? Isn't that so?
Yes, she said. I have a car. An old Studebaker.
The fry cook glanced from her to the young truck driver, and then set her plate before her at the counter. The loudspeaker at the end of the aisle said,
Achtung, meine Damen und Herren!
In his seat, Mr. Bain started, opened his eyes. Through the window to his right, he could see, far below, the brown and green of land, and then blue, the Pacific. The rocket, he realized, had begun its long, slow descent. In German first, then Japanese, and at last English, the loudspeaker explained that no one was to smoke or to untie himself from his padded seat. The descent, it explained, would take 8 minutes. The retrojets started then, so suddenly and loudly, shaking the ship so violently that a number of passengers gasped. Mr. Baines smiled, and in the aisle seat across from him, another passenger, a younger man with close-cropped blonde hair, also smiled.
Sie fürchten das,
the young man began. But Mr. Baines said at once in English,
I'm sorry, I don't speak German.
The young German gazed at him questioningly, and so he said the same thing in German.
No German?
The young German said, amazed in accented English.
I am Swedish, Bain said.
You embarked at Tempelhof?
Yes, I was in Germany on business. My business carries me to a number of countries.
Clearly, the young German could not believe that anyone in the modern world, anyone who had international business dealings and rode, could afford to ride, on the latest Lufthansa rocket, could or would not speak German. To Baines, he said,
"What line are you in, mein Herr?"
"Plastics, polyesters, resins, ersatz, industrial uses. Do you see? No consumers' commodities."
"Sweden has a plastics industry?"
"Disbelief."
"Yes, a very good one. If you will give me your name, I will have a firm brochure mailed to you."
Mr. Baines brought out his pen and pad.
"Never mind. It would be wasted on me. I am an artist, not a commercial man. No offense. Possibly you have seen my work while on the continent. Alex Lotze."
He waited.
"Afraid I do not care for modern art," Mr. Baines said. "I like the old pre-war cubists and abstractionists. I like a picture to mean something, not merely to represent the ideal."
He turned away.
"But that's the task of art," Lotze said. "To advance the spirituality of man over the sensual. Your abstract art represented a period of spiritual decadence, of spiritual chaos, due to the disintegration of society, the old plutocracy, the Jewish and capitalist millionaires, the international set that supported the decadent art. Those times are over. Art has to go on. It can't stay still."
Baines nodded, gazing out the window.
"Have you been to the Pacific before?" Lotze asked.
"Several times."
"Not I. There is an exhibition in San Francisco of my work, arranged by Dr. Goebel's office, with the Japanese authorities. A cultural exchange to promote understanding and goodwill. We must ease tensions between the East and West, don't you think? We must have more communication, and art can do that."
Baines nodded. Below, beyond the ring of fire from the rocket, the city of San Francisco and the bay could now be seen.
"Where does one eat in San Francisco?"
Lotze was saying.
"I have reservations at the Palace Hotel, but my understanding is that one can find good food in the international section, such as Chinatown."
"True," Baines said.
"Are prices high in San Francisco? I am out of pocket for this trip."
"The ministry is very frugal," Lotze laughed.
"Depends on the exchange rate you can manage. I presume you are carrying Reichsbank drafts? I suggest you go to the Bank of Tokyo on Samson Street and exchange there."
"Danke sehr," Lotze said. "I would have done it at the hotel."
The rocket had almost reached the ground. Now Baines could see the airfield itself, hangars, parking lots, the Autobahn from the city, the houses. Very lovely view, he thought. Mountains and water, and a few bits of fog drifting in at the Golden Gate.
"What is that enormous structure below?"
Lotze asked.
"It is half finished, open at one side. A spaceport? The Nipponese have no spacecraft, I thought."
With a smile, Baines said, "That's Golden Poppy Stadium, the baseball park." Lotze laughed.
"Yes, they love baseball. Incredible. They have begun work on that great structure for a pastime, an idle, time-wasting sport."
Interrupting, Baines said, "It is finished. That's its permanent shape, open on one side. A new architectural design. They are very proud of it."
"It looks," Lotze said, gazing down, "as if it was designed by a Jew."
Baines regarded the man for a time. He felt, strongly for a moment, the unbalanced quality, the psychotic streak in the German mind. Did Lotze actually mean what he said? Was it a truly spontaneous remark?
"I hope we will see one another later on in San Francisco," Lotze said,
as the rocket touched the ground.
I will be at loose ends without a countryman to talk to.
I'm not a countryman of yours, Bane said.
Oh, yes, that's so. But racially, you're quite close. For all intents and purposes, the same.
Lhotse began to stir around in his seat, getting ready to unfasten the elaborate belts.
Am I racially kin to this man? Baines wondered. So closely so that for all intents and purposes it is the same? Then it is in me, too, the psychotic streak. A psychotic world we live in. The madmen are in power. How long have we known this? Faced this? And how many of us do know it? Not Lhotse. Perhaps if you know you are insane, then you are not insane. Or you are becoming sane, finally, waking up. I suppose only a few are aware of all this. Isolated persons here and there. But the broad masses, what do they think? All these hundreds of thousands in this city here, do they imagine that they live in a sane world? Or do they guess, glimpse, the truth? But, he thought, what does it mean, insane? A legal definition? What do I mean? I feel it, see it. But what is it? He thought, it is something they do, something they are. It is their unconsciousness, their lack of knowledge about others, their not being aware of what they do to others, the destruction they have caused and are causing. No, he thought, that isn't it. I don't know. I sense it, intuit it. But they are purposely cruel. Is that it? No. God, he thought, I can't find it. Make it clear. Do they ignore parts of reality? Yes, but it is more. It is their plans. Yes, their plans. The conquering of the planets. Something frenzied and demented, as was their conquering of Africa, and before that, Europe and Asia. Their view. It is cosmic. Not of a man here, a child there, but an abstraction. Race, land. Volk, Land. Blut, Air. Not of honorable men, but of Era itself. Honor. The abstract is real. The actual is invisible to them. Die Güte. But not good men. This good man. It is their sense of space and time. They see through the here, the now, into the vast black deep beyond, the unchanging. And that is fatal to life. Because eventually there will be no life. There was once only the dust particles in space, the hot hydrogen gases, nothing more. And it will come again. This is an interval. Ein Augenblick. The cosmic process is hurrying on, crushing life back into the granite and methane. The wheel turns for all life. It is all temporary. And they, these madmen, respond to the granite, the dust, the longing of the inanimate. They want to aid Natur. And, he thought, I know why. They want to be the agents, not the victims, of history. They identify with God's power and believe they are godlike. That is their basic madness. They are overcome by some archetype. Their egos have expanded psychotically so that they cannot tell where they begin and the godhead leaves off. It is not hubris, not pride. It is inflation of the ego to its ultimate confusion between him who worships and that which is worshipped. Man has not eaten God. God has eaten man. What they do not comprehend is man's helplessness. I am weak,
small, of no consequence to the universe. It does not notice me. I live on unseen. But why is that bad? Isn't it better that way? Whom the gods notice, they destroy. Be small, and you will escape the jealousy of the great. As he unfastened his own belt, Bane said, Mr. Lotze, I have never told anyone this. I am a Jew. Do you understand? Lotze stared at him piteously. You would not have known, Bane said, because I do not in any physical way appear Jewish. I have had my nose altered, my large greasy pores made smaller, my skin chemically lightened, the shape of my skull changed. In short, physically, I cannot be detected. I can, and have often, walked in the highest circles of Nazi society. No one will ever discover me, and... He paused, standing close, very close to Lotze, and speaking in a low voice which only Lotze could hear. And there are others of us. Do you hear? We did not die. We still exist. We live on unseen. After a moment, Lotze stuttered, The security police! The SD can go over my record, Bane said. You can report me. But I have very high connections. Some of them are Aryan. Some are other Jews in top positions in Berlin. Your report will be discounted, and then, presently, I will report you. And through these same connections, you will find yourself in protective custody. He smiled, nodded, and walked up the aisle of the ship, away from Lotze, to join the other passengers. Everyone descended the ramp onto the cold, windy field. At the bottom, Baines found himself once more momentarily near Lotze.
In fact, Baines said, walking beside Lotze, I do not like your looks, Mr. Lotze, so I think I will report you anyhow.
He strode on, then, leaving Lotze behind. At the far end of the field, at the concourse entrance, a large number of people were waiting. Relatives, friends of passengers, some of them waving, peering, smiling, looking anxious, scanning faces. A heavy-set middle-aged Japanese man, well-dressed in a British overcoat, pointed Oxfords, bowler, stood a little ahead of the others, with a younger Japanese beside him. On his coat lapel he wore the badge of the ranking Pacific Trade Mission of the Imperial Government.
There he is, Baines realized.
Mr. N. Tagomi, come personally to meet me. Starting forward, the Japanese called,
Herr Baines, good evening.
His head tilted hesitantly.
Good evening, Mr. Tagomi,
Baines said, holding out his hand. They shook, then bowed. The younger Japanese also bowed, beaming.
Bit cold, sir, on this exposed field, Mr. Tagomi said. We shall begin return trip to downtown city by mission helicopter. Is that so? Or do you need to use the facilities and so forth?
He scrutinized Mr. Baines's face anxiously.
We can start right now, Baines said. I want to check in at my hotel. My baggage, however... Mr. Kotomichi will attend to that, Mr. Tagomi said. He will follow. You see, sir, at this terminal, it takes almost an hour waiting in line to claim baggage. Longer than your trip.
Mr. Kotomichi smiled agreeably.
All right, Baines said.
Mr. Tagomi said,
Sir, I have a gift to graft.
I beg your pardon, Baines said.
To invite your favorable attitude.
Mr. Tagomi reached into his overcoat pocket and brought out a small box.
Selected from among the finest objects d'art of America available.
He held out the box.
Well, Baines said. Thanks.
He accepted the box.
All afternoon assorted officials examined the alternatives, Mr. Tagomi said. This is most authentic of dying old U.S. culture, a rare retained artifact carrying flavor of bygone halcyon day.
Mr. Baines opened the box. In it lay a Mickey Mouse wristwatch on a pad of black velvet. Was Mr. Tagomi playing a joke on him? He raised his eyes, saw Mr. Tagomi's tense, concerned face. No, it was not a joke.
Thank you very much, Baines said. This is indeed incredible. Only few, perhaps 10, authentic 1938 Mickey Mouse watches in all world today,
Mr. Tagomi said, studying him, drinking in his reaction, his appreciation.
No collector known to me has one, sir.
They entered the air terminal and together ascended the ramp. Behind them, Mr. Kodomichi said,
Harusume ni nuretsutsu yane no tamari kana.
What is that? Mr. Baines said to Mr. Tagomi.
Old poem,
Mr. Tagomi said.
Middle Tokugawa period.
Mr. Kodomichi said,
As the spring rains fall, soaking in them, on the roof is a child's rag ball.
4. As Frank Frank watched his ex-employer waddle down the corridor and into the main work area of WM Corporation, he thought to himself,
The strange thing about Wyndham Matson is that he does not look like a man who owns a factory. He looks like a tenderloin bum, a wino, who has been given a bath, new clothes, a shave, haircut, shot of vitamins, and set out into the world with $5 to find a new life.
The old man had a weak, shifty, nervous, even ingratiating manner, as if he regarded everyone as a potential enemy stronger than he, whom he had to fawn on and pacify.
They're going to get me, his manner seemed to say.
And yet old WM was really very powerful. He owned controlling interests in a variety of enterprises, speculations, real estate, as well as the WM Corporation factory. Following after the old man, Frank pushed open the big metal door to the main work area. The rumble of machinery, which he had heard around him every day for so long. Sight of men at the machines, air filled with flash of light, waste dust, movement. There went the old man. Frank increased his pace.
Hey, Mr. WM, he called.
The old man had stopped by the hairy-armed shop foreman, Ed McCarthy. Both of them glanced up as Frank came toward them. Moistening his lips nervously, Wyndham Matson said,
I'm sorry, Frank. I can't do anything about taking you back. I've already gone ahead and hired someone to take your place, thinking you weren't coming back. After what you said...
His small round eyes flickered with what Frank knew to be an almost hereditary evasiveness. It was in the old man's blood. Frank said,
I came for my tools, nothing else.
His own voice, he was glad to hear, was firm, even harsh.
Well, let's see,
WM mumbled, obviously hazy in his own mind as to the status of Frank's tools. To Ed McCarthy, he said,
Now, I think that would be in your department, Ed. Maybe you can fix Frank here up. I have other business.
He glanced at his pocket watch.
Listen, Ed, I'll discuss that invoice later. I have to run along.
He patted Ed McCarthy on the arm and then trotted off, not looking back. Ed McCarthy and Frank stood together.
You came to get your job back, McCarthy said after a time.
Yes,
Frank said.
I was proud of what you said yesterday.
So was I,
Frank said.
But, Christ, I can't work it out anywhere else.
He felt defeated and hopeless.
You know that.
The two of them had, in the past, often talked over their problems. McCarthy said,
I don't know that. You're as good with that flex cable machine as anybody on the coast. I've seen you whip out a piece in 5 minutes, including the rouge polishing. All the way from the rough Cratex. And except for the welding, I never said I could weld,
Frank said.
Did you ever think of going into business on your own?
Frank, taken by surprise, stammered.
What doing? Jewelry.
Oh, for Christ's sake.
Custom, original pieces, not commercial.
McCarthy beckoned him over to a corner of the shop, away from the noise.
For about $2,000, you could set up a little basement or garage shop. One time I drew up designs for women's earrings and pendants. You remember? Real modern, contemporary.
Taking scratch paper, he began to draw, slowly, grimly. Peering over his shoulder, Frank saw a bracelet design, an abstract with flowing lines.
Is there a market?
All he had ever seen were the traditional, even antique, objects from the past.
Nobody wants contemporary American. There isn't any such thing. Not since the war. Create a market, McCarthy said with an angry grimace.
You mean sell it myself?
Take it into retail shops. Like that, what's it called? On Montgomery Street. That big ritzy art object place.
American artistic handcrafts, Frank said.
He never went into fashionable, expensive stores such as that. Few Americans did. It was the Japanese who had the money to buy from such places.
You know what retailers like that are selling? McCarthy said. And getting a fortune for? Those goddamn silver belt buckles from New Mexico that the Indians make. Those goddamn tourist trash pieces. All alike. Supposedly native art.
For a long time, Frank regarded McCarthy.
I know what else they sell, he said finally.
And so do you.
Yes,
McCarthy said. They both knew, because they had both been directly involved, and for a long time. WM Corporation's stated legal business consisted in turning out wrought iron staircases, railings, fireplaces, and ornaments for new apartment buildings, all on a mass basis, from standard designs. For a new 40-unit building, the same piece would be executed 40 times in a row. Ostensibly, WM Corporation was an iron foundry. But in addition, it maintained another business from which its real profits were derived. Using an elaborate variety of tools, materials, and machines, WM Corporation turned out a constant flow of forgeries of pre-war American artifacts. These forgeries were cautiously but expertly fed into the wholesale art object market to join the genuine objects collected throughout the continent. As in the stamp and coin business, no one could possibly estimate the percentage of forgeries in circulation. And no one, especially the dealers and the collectors themselves, wanted to. When Frank had quit, there lay half-finished on his bench a Colt revolver of the frontier period. He had made the molds himself, done the casting, and had been busy hand-smoothing the pieces. There was an unlimited market for small arms of the American Civil War and frontier period. WM Corporation could sell all that Frank could turn out. It was his specialty. Walking slowly over to his bench, Frank picked up the still rough and burred ramrod of the revolver. Another 3 days and the gun would be finished. Yes, he thought. It was good work. An expert could have told the difference, but the Japanese collectors weren't authorities in the proper sense, had no standards or tests by which to judge. In fact, as far as he knew, it had never occurred to them to ask themselves if the so-called historic art objects for sale in West Coast shops were genuine. Perhaps someday they would. And then the bubble would burst. The market would collapse even for the authentic pieces. A Gresham's Law. The fakes would undermine the value of the real. And that, no doubt, was the motive for the failure to investigate. After all, everyone was happy. The factories, here and there in the various cities, which turned out the pieces, they made their profits. The wholesalers passed them on, and the dealers displayed and advertised them. The collectors shelled out their money and carried their purchases happily home to impress their associates, friends, and mistresses. Like post-war boodle paper money, it was fine until questioned. Nobody was hurt until the day of reckoning. And then everyone, equally, would be ruined. But meanwhile, nobody talked about it. Even the men who earned their living turning out the forgeries, they shut their own minds to what they made, kept their attention on the mere technical problems.
How long since you tried to do original designing?
McCarthy asked. Frink shrugged.
Years. I can copy accurately as hell. But...
You know what I think?
I think you've picked up the Nazi idea that Jews can't create, that they can only imitate and sell. Middlemen.
He fixed his merciless scrutiny on Frink.
Maybe so, Frink said. Try it. Do some original designs. Or work directly on the metal. Play around, like a kid plays.
No, Frink said.
You have no faith,
McCarthy said.
You've completely lost faith in yourself, right?
Too bad,
because I know you could do it.
He walked away from the workbench.
It is too bad, Frink thought. But nevertheless, it's the truth. It's a fact. I can't get faith or enthusiasm by willing it, deciding to. That McCarthy, he thought, is a damn good shop foreman. He has the knack of needling a man, getting him to put out his best efforts, to do his utmost in spite of himself. He's a natural leader. He almost inspired me for a moment there.
But McCarthy had gone off now. The effort had failed.
Too bad I don't have my copy of the Oracle here, Frink thought. I could consult it on this. Take the issue to it for its 5,000 years of wisdom.
And then he recalled that there was a copy of the I Ching in the lounge of the business office of WM Corporation. So he made his way from the work area, along the corridor, hurriedly through the business office to the lounge. Seated in one of the chrome and plastic lounge chairs, he wrote his question out on the back of an envelope. Should I attempt to go into the creative private business outlined to me just now? And then he began throwing the coins. The bottom line was a 7, and so was the second, and then the third. The bottom trigram in Qian, he realized. That sounded good. Qian was the creative. Then line 4. An 8. Yin. And line 5? Also 8. A yin line. Good Lord, he thought excitedly. One more yin line and I've got hexagram 11. Tai. Peace. Very favorable judgment. Or, his hands trembled as he rattled the coins, a yang line and hence hexagram 26. Ta Chu. The taming power of the great. Both have favorable judgments. And it has to be one or the other. He threw the 3 coins. Yin, a 6. It was peace. Opening the book, he read the judgment. Peace. The small departs. The great approaches. Good fortune. Success. So I ought to do as Ed McCarthy says. Open my little business. Now the 6 at the top, my 1 moving line. He turned the page. What was the text? He could not recall. Probably favorable because the hexagram itself was so favorable. Union of heaven and earth. But the first and last lines were outside the hexagram always. So possibly the 6 at the top? His eyes picked out the line, read it in a flash. The wall falls back into the moat. Use no army now. Make your commands known within your own town. Perseverance brings humiliation. My busted back, he exclaimed, horrified. And the commentary? The change alluded to in the middle of the hexagram has begun to take place. The wall of the town sinks back into the moat from which it was dug. The hour of doom is at hand. It was, beyond doubt, one of the most dismal lines in the entire book, of more than 3,000 lines. And yet the judgment of the hexagram was good. Which was he supposed to follow? And how could they be so different? It had never happened to him before. Good fortune and doom mixed together in the oracle's prophecy. What a weird fate. As if the oracle had scraped the bottom of the barrel, tossed up every sort of rag, bone, and turd of the dark, then reversed itself and poured in the light like a cook gone barmy. I must have pressed 2 buttons at once, he decided. Jammed the works and got this schlamazel's eye view of reality. Just for a second,
fortunately. Didn't last. Hell, he thought. It has to be one or the other. It can't be both. You can't have good fortune and doom simultaneously. Or...
can you?
The jewelry business will bring good fortune. The judgment refers to that. But the line, the goddamn line, it refers to something deeper. Some future catastrophe probably not even connected with the jewelry business. Some evil fate that's in store for me anyhow. War, he thought. Third World War. All friggin' 2 billion of us killed. Our civilization wiped out. Hydrogen bombs falling like hail. Oy, Gavalt, he thought. What's happening? Did I start it in motion? Or is someone else tinkering? Someone I don't even know? Or the whole lot of us? It's the fault of those physicists and that synchronicity theory. Every particle being connected with every other. You can't fart without changing the balance in the universe. It makes living a funny joke with nobody around to laugh. I open a book and get a report on future events that even God would like to file and forget. And who am I? The wrong person, I can tell you that. I should take my tools, get my motors from McCarthy, open my shop, start my piddling business, go on despite the horrible line. Be working, creating in my own way, right up to the end, living as best I can, as actively as possible, until the wall falls back into the moat for all of us, all mankind. That's what the Oracle is telling me. Fate will poleaxe us eventually anyhow. But I have my job in the meantime. I must use my mind, my hands. The judgment was for me alone, for my work. But the line, it was for us all. I'm too small, he thought. I can only read what's written, glance up and then lower my head and plod along where I left off as if I hadn't seen. The Oracle doesn't expect me to start running up and down the streets, squalling and yammering for public attention. Can anyone alter it? He wondered. All of us combined? Or one great figure? Or someone strategically placed who happens to be in the right spot? Chance. Accident. And our lives, our world, hanging on it. Closing the book, he left the lounge and walked back to the main work area. When he caught sight of McCarthy, he waved him over to one side where they could resume talk. The more I think about it, Frink said, the more I like your idea. Fine, McCarthy said. Now listen, here's what you do. You have to get money from Wyndham Matson. He winked, a slow, intense, frightened twitch of his eyelid. I figured out how. I'm going to quit and go in with you. My design, see? What's wrong with that? I know they're good. Sure, Frink said, a little dazed. I'll see you after work tonight, McCarthy said. At my apartment. You come over around 7 and have dinner with Jean and me, if you can stand the kids. Okay, Frink said. McCarthy gave him a slap on the shoulder and went off. I've gone a long way, Frink said to himself, in the last 10 minutes. But he did not feel apprehensive. He felt, now, excitement. It sure happened fast, he thought as he walked over to his bench and began collecting his tools. I guess that's how those kinds of things happen. Opportunity, when it comes. All my life I've waited for this. When the Oracle says something must be achieved, it means this. The time is truly great. What is the time now? What is this moment? 6 at the top and hexagram 11 changes everything to 26, taming power of the great. Yin becomes yang. The line moves, and a new moment appears. And I was so off stride, I didn't even notice. I'll bet that's why I got that terrible line. That's the only way hexagram 11 can change to hexagram 26, by that moving 6 at the top. So I shouldn't get my ass in such an uproar. But, despite his excitement and optimism, he could not get the line completely out of his mind. However, he thought ironically, I'm making a damn good try. By 7 tonight, maybe I'll have managed to forget it like it never happened. He thought,
I sure hope so. Because this get-together with Ed is big. He's got some surefire idea, I can tell, and I don't intend to find myself left out. Right now, I'm nothing, but if I can swing this, then maybe I can get Juliana back. I know what she wants. She deserves to be married.